turned out, was the easy part. Yes, it was a little odd to get used to. It wasn't as if I could read Araya's mind or communicate without speaking or feel everything she felt. And hell, what fun would that be anyway, to take all the mystery out of things? It was more that I was now constantly, innately aware of her. A biological attunement to her presence, her state, her emotions. Right now, though, I didn't need any kind of magical goddess-gifted heart bond to know that Araya was pissed. She was wearing that "a cat is pissing on my leg and you're the cat" face. My favorite of the diverse library of Araya faces. Her arms were crossed over her chest, her foot tapping impatiently. We were in the meeting room, me leaning back in my chair, Araya bolt upright in hers. Keturah, Vale, Lilith, Jasmine, and Misha sat scattered around the table. Misha was half slumped across the desk. Lilith was eternally thoughtful. Keturah and Vale were both visibly annoyed, and Jasmine was, of course, ever the Ice Queen.
"He has to be somewhere," Araya said. "I'm sure he is somewhere," Jasmine said, pursing her lips. "Snake that he is. But that somewhere is not in the House of Night. Did you check?"
"We checked everywhere,"
Keturah said, throwing her notes down.
"Everywhere."
Keturah's frustration, I knew, wasn't with Araya. It was with herself. She hated losing.
"He must have retreated with the rest of the Bloodborne," Jasmine said. "Was quick about it, apparently."
None of this surprised me. I wanted Septimus in captivity as much as anyone else, but I was under no illusions that he was about to let himself be caught easily. He was far too smart for that, as much as I hated to give him the credit. These last few weeks had been a blur, establishing the fragile legs of our new kingdom and eliminating the final parasites of the old one. The Bloodborne, at least, had been easy to get rid of. The minute the goddess showed up, they apparently knew nothing good was happening and began their retreat. By the time the fighting had stopped and Jasmine and Vale had retrieved Araya and I, most of the Bloodborne troops were already on their way out of the kingdom. No one objected to letting them go. Good riddance. The only one we wanted was Septimus. But he, it seemed, had been the first to leave, though Jasmine and Vale both gave orders to have him detained immediately before Araya and I had even awoken. He had simply disappeared. And these last few weeks had been no more fruitful, not even as our guards tore through all potential strongholds and searched fleets of departing Bloodborne soldiers. Septimus was long, long gone. Vale let out a sigh and rubbed his temples.
"Let him slink away with his tail between his legs. If that's how he needs to deal with his defeat, so be it. We have plenty of other traitors to prosecute, and at least those won't start a war."
He tapped the parchment in front of him, black with dozens, hundreds of names.
"Another war," Jasmine corrected,
and Vale sighed again.
"Yes, let's avoid another war, especially one with another house."
Misha shifted uncomfortably in her seat. I knew she was thinking about the House of Shadow. We'd been lucky so far, not a word from them about their prince. If that changed, our strategy was to pin it on Simon, let them believe that justice had already been served. Risky, but it was the best we had. Misha, I knew, thought about this possibility more than she let on.
"We did find someone else,"
Keturah said, jerking my attention back to the meeting.
"In the latest set of raids?"
I blinked, turning to her. "Someone important?" Her face hardened, like she'd just smelled something very unpleasant.
"Someone I think you might want to talk to."
Karis looked horrible. Then again, it would be a little disappointing if he didn't, after hours of questioning by Keturah and Vale's men. He looked up through the bars, a ray of moonlight falling over his face as he squinted up at me through a swollen eye.
"Oh,"
his mouth twisted into a wry smirk, a pathetic recreation of his typical smile.
"Hello. Sorry I won't be very useful. I already told them everything."
"I figured as much." I sat down in the chair before the bars, elbows on my knees. Behind me, Araya slipped into the room too, lingering in the shadows against the wall.
I found it satisfying the way his face dropped with actual fear when he saw her. She found it satisfying too. I sensed it alongside my own.
"So what then?" he said. "You've come here to execute me yourself?"
He stood up, as if to prepare himself to meet death standing.
"No," I said. "My time's too valuable for that."
Confusion flitted over Karis's face.
"Then what?"
"Couture and Vale wanted to execute you." I nodded back toward Aurea. "Your queen wanted to execute you, bloodthirsty little thing that she was. But," I said, "I managed to convince them otherwise." His brow furrowed. I wanted to make sure I saw your face when the man you betrayed saved your life," I said. "And I also wanted to make sure you knew it was no mercy. Actually, the queen that wanted to kill you was probably the merciful one." I stood, my silhouette casting a shadow over Karis's form. I towered over him. He wasn't a small man either, but he seemed it now. I supposed he always had been. But how could he be anything but? He'd spent his entire life in fear. He'd learned to survive by bending his spine to fit into his cages. For a while, he'd been able to make himself into something more. For a while. But as soon as he found himself staring down the possibility of being a slave again, he just couldn't go back. No values were strong enough to supplant that fear. I wasn't sure if it made it better or worse that I understood it. He lowered his eyes. There was shame, real shame in them.
"I deserve to be executed," he said.
"You do. That's why you won't be." "That and," I cocked my head and smiled at him, wide enough to reveal my fangs. "I think you might be useful one day. So you'll be locked up in Tazarak. Spend a decade or four there until I decide if I need you for something. People who have something to prove are the most useful kind." His eyes rose to meet mine again, round. His mouth opened, but nothing came out. "If you're considering whether or not to thank me," I said, "I think the answer is probably no." He shut his mouth, but he still said a moment later,
"Thank you."
I chuckled. I started to turn away, but he said,
"Do you really think you're going to be able to make this work?"
I stopped. Aurea and I exchanged a glance. I turned around. "This?" I questioned. I saw it on Karis's face the moment he saw Aurea's back, the air mark, visible above the low back of her blouse before she, too, turned back to him. His eyes widened. I laughed softly and pulled open the top two buttons of my jacket, revealing my mark, too. "They're new," I said. "Like them?"
"You did it," he breathed.
The shock on his face was so satisfyingly genuine. Either he'd been living in true isolation wherever he'd been hiding out, or he'd heard the rumors and thought we were lying. Either option amused me.
"We did," Aurea said. He paled.
"What?" I said. "Realizing now you picked the wrong side?" I was only half joking because Karis really did look like he was questioning everything he'd held as truth. He had played by the rules of Neculi's game right up to the end, thinking it was the only strategy that could ever win. And here we were, crowns on our heads, having blown the entire board to bits. He said softly,
"Yes, I am."
"You're lucky for it," I said. "Simon would have had you skinned by now." I started to turn away, but again he called out,
"Wait!"
Now I was getting impatient. I turned back, brows raised expectantly.
"Septimus isn't done," he said,
then raised his hands, as if in preemptive defense.
"I've told Keturah everything I know. I don't have any more facts. It's a feeling. I know it. He's doing something big, Rain. I don't know what it is. But don't let your guard down.
My smirk faded. Araya and I exchanged another glance. She raised her brows in a way that said, "See, didn't I tell you?" I gave her a flat stare that said, "Yes, you told me."
"Well," I said to Karis, "we'll be ready for him. Whenever he decides to show up. The truth? What else could we offer?" I closed the door behind us as we left, leaving Karis alone in the dark.
Chapter 78. Araya. I was nervous. I stood in front of the mirror for a borderline embarrassing amount of time. I could admit that I looked good. A small army of servants had seen to that, painting my face, smoothing my hair, pinching and prodding my body so that every swell swelled and every dip dipped in all the right places in this dress. Though I definitely couldn't take credit for making this thing look good. It was nothing short of a work of art. Even more magnificent, somehow, than the one I'd worn at Vale and Lilith's wedding. It was dark purple, nearly black, and tailored close to my body. It was scandalously revealing, cut low enough to reveal the dimples at the base of my spine, and plunging in the front, the bodice dipping between my breasts. It was designed to frame both my marks, and it did that very well, the shape complementing every curve and point of the tattoos. The bodice was boned with deep red that echoed the color of the marks, and those bones at my hips gave way to dots of scattered silver that resembled stars, growing thicker as they reached the skirt. It rivaled the craftsmanship of every weapon I'd ever held. And I did look every bit a queen, as I should. The first few weeks of our joint reign had been tense, uncertain. But over the last month, Rain and I had worked hard to cement our rule over the House of Night. The traitors had been sentenced, the Bloodborne had been expelled, rebellious nobles had been deposed. No one had come for our heads. Yet. But tonight was the first major festival to take place since the end of the war. Rain and I would appear before the most respected of vampire society, and we'd make our offering to Nyaxia for the new lunar year. We'd need to be royal. Fucking royal. When 1 year ago, I'd spent this holiday barred up in my room, forbidden by Vincent to come to the festivities. It had been just a few short weeks before the start of the Qajari. Little did I know then how close I was to everything changing. I knew Rain was approaching before I heard his footsteps. I often did now. He appeared behind me in the mirror, peering through the open doorway. He let out a low whistle. "Really?" I said, turning around and examining the dress from the back. "You think so?"
"What the hell else would I think?"
He approached, and I watched him through the mirror. Goddess, the tailors were damned artists. His outfit complemented mine, cut from the same shade of deep purple cloth, the cuffs and the collar adorned with the same star accents. It was also incredibly flattering. The jacket was shaped impeccably to his body. The button started low, leaving the top open to reveal deliberate glimpses of his mark, along with a decidedly noticeable expanse of muscled flesh.
"You know," Rain said, "it's very easy for me to tell now when you're doing that."
"Doing what?" I said innocently. He was one to talk, as if I didn't also feel his eyes on my chest. I turned around to face him. My fingertips ran down his throat, tracing the lines of his mark all the way down to the soft hair of his chest. I thought of the night of the Half Moon Ball, when he'd opened his jacket for me and practically offered up his heart.
"Are you going to kill me, princess?"
Turned out, that answer was yes. He tipped my chin up.
"You look too good to be this nervous."
"It seems like whenever I look this good, something terrible happens." He choked a laugh.
"You may have a point there. I'd survived a few coups now, and you looking good was a factor in at least two of them."
Bloodshed and ball gowns. They really went together. But I wasn't ready to joke about it. The memory of the wedding was still too fresh.
That, too, had been a grand gesture to show off the power of a new regime to its most important subjects. And look how that had ended. Rain swept his thumb over the wrinkle on my brow.
What's that face for?
I stared at him, deadpan, because he knew what that face was for.
Nothing to be nervous about, he said.
My eyebrows lowered, because fuck that bullshit. I knew he was nervous, too. He sighed.
Fine, you have me, but I'm feeling better already, because if you walk in there wearing that face, it'll put any doubts about our brutal, terrifying power to rest.
I couldn't help it. I laughed.
There we go.
He smiled. Even though I could still feel the unease beneath it, the expression tugged deep in my chest. There was genuine happiness in that smile. Something a little looser that hadn't existed when we'd first met. I remembered the first time I'd heard Rain laugh, and it had struck me because I didn't know it was possible for anyone to laugh like that, so freely. He smiled like that too, totally unvampiric. I couldn't help but return it. A knock rang out at the door. Keturah poked her head in. The moon is rising, she said. Everyone's ready for you. Rain glanced at me and raised his brows as if to say, well, this is it. I took his arm and very subtly wiped the sweat from my palms on his sleeve.
Nice,
he muttered into my ear as we followed Keturah out the door. Rain and I were led to the balcony of the castle. Not long ago, Rain had been strung up here to die. Now, we would stand here to address our people. This feast was always one of Sivrinaj's grandest, and this year's was especially grand besides. In light of our current unique circumstances, we decided to open it up more than usual, allowing citizens of Sivrinaj into the outer reaches of the palace grounds. Within the innermost walls, the nobles and officials gathered, all those, of course, who had sworn loyalty to the new king and queen, a crowd of Hiaj, Rishon, and human alike. A year ago? Hell, months ago? Such a thing would have been incomprehensible. A year ago, the thought of even being among all these people, with my throat exposed, would have been paralyzing. A wave of that terror passed over me as Rain and I approached the doorway, and I saw the sea of faces beneath. Hundreds, maybe thousands. I paused at the silver arch, dizzy. Rain's hand found the small of my back, his thumb swirling a single comforting circle on bare skin. He leaned close to me, his lips brushing my ear.
You're safe,
he murmured. Seemed like some kind of magic that he always made me believe him. I straightened my back, wound my fingers through his, and strode out to greet my people alongside him. Somewhere below, voices rang out in perfect unison. Announcing on this blessed eve the arrival of the king and queen of the House of Night. The words shivered through the air, hanging there like smoke. They slithered over my skin. I felt Rain flinch at them too, like the reality of them struck him in a way he wasn't expecting. A ripple of movement, as all those countless eyes turned to us. I stopped breathing. And I still didn't breathe, couldn't, as all those people, Rishon, Hiaj, and human, lowered into bows like a wave rolling across the sea. Goddess, help me. What a sight it was. I let out a shaky exhale. I was grateful for Rain's hand, clutching mine so hard it trembled. He glanced at me through the corner of his eye, crinkled slightly with a smile of relief. I muttered, quietly enough for only him to hear, and you didn't even have to rip off anyone's head. Rain stifled his chuckle. The ceremony itself was brief. No vampire wanted to spend more time watching a bunch of religious ritual more than they wanted to spend it eating and drinking and fucking. The feast was to commemorate the end of one lunar year and the beginning of a new one. I'd seen Vincent perform this rite only once before, and I'd had to sneak out to do it, watching from the rooftop of a nearby building and quietly creeping away before anyone could smell me. It was, needless to say, very different when you were at the center of it. Rain and I had to give Nyaxia three offerings. First, wine, to thank her for the abundance of the year and ask for abundance in the next. We held the glass goblet up together,
raising it to the sky, our magic urging the liquid from the glass in an eel-like swirl of deep red and sending it to the stars above. Then, the bone of an enemy, in appreciation for her protection and in request for continued strength. We had more than enough to pick from this year, but it seemed particularly appropriate to offer her one of Simon's, a finger bone. We held the polished piece of ivory up to the sky, and with a flash of black light, Rain's asterisk reduced it to dust, swept away in the wind. And finally, we would offer her our blood. This was the most important of the three offerings, the one that signaled our eternal loyalty and devotion. She had made our blood what it was, the scriptures said, and thus we would offer it back to her as a sign of our fealty. Tonight, this seemed a little redundant, given just how much of it we'd spilled for her over the last few months, but neither of us was going to complain about a little more. Rain and I made this offering together, our blood shared. We used my blade, because of course I still carried them everywhere, to open cuts across our palms. Then we pressed our hands together and cupped them. When we lifted them to the night sky, we offered Nyaxia a pool of mingling crimson and black. Traditionally, Nyaxia would take this offering herself, calling the blood up to the stars. But now, nothing happened. Long seconds passed. Rain and I both grew silently more tense. If Nyaxia didn't accept the offering, it would make a terrible impression on such an important night. I was prepared to fake it if I had to. It was all a show, after all. Our magic was more than capable of convincingly swirling some blood around in the air. But finally, after what felt like an eternity, but was only seconds, the blood rose. It danced against the velvet black like an unfurling wisp of liquid smoke before being consumed by the darkness. Rain and I let out simultaneous exhales of relief. The spectators, oblivious, broke into applause, mostly cheering that they were now free to go feast and drink. We turned to address them, raising our hands in celebration and thanks, and we looked every bit the picture of the royalty we were supposed to be. But my eyes drifted up to the night sky, where swirls of odd gleaming clouds lingered, like clustered fragments of moonlight. And for some reason, Acacia's warning rang out in my mind. There will come a day when Nyaxia will bring a reckoning. Not today, not tomorrow, but it will come. Then I blinked, and the strange clouds disappeared, like they'd never existed at all. Just another figment of my imagination.
Chapter 79. Rain. The feast was one for the record books. Historians would one day write about this party, though they'd have to make some things up because if they were there, they were probably too drunk to remember it firsthand. It was almost a shame that Karis wasn't around to appreciate it. He'd have been impressed. After the ceremony, Aurea and I were thrown into engagement after engagement, shuffled around by Vale and Lilith from one set of nobles to another, making deadly polite conversation and making sure all the right people knew just how frightening and powerful we were. I preferred the Qajari. I was much more comfortable fighting with swords than words. Still, Aurea and I both turned out to be better at this than we thought. The hours wore on, and the event was, by all accounts, a success. It was the small hours of the morning by the time I finally managed to slip away from my obligations. Aurea and I had gotten separated some time ago, Vale dragging me one way and Jasmine dragging her another. But one of the many benefits of the Coriatis bond was that I now always knew when Aurea was safe and when she wasn't. I sensed no hint of distress, so instead of fighting through the crowd to look for her and risking getting pulled aside by yet another Rishon noble, I decided to find someone I actually wanted to talk to. It was never that hard to find Misha at these types of events. She was always either near the food or the flowers. This time I found her near the flowers. She'd wandered away from the main party, walking through the garden's blooming shrubberies. When I came across her, she was staring into a wall of blossoms, silhouetted against them. I paused for a moment, my smile fading. Something about the image was so sad. "Careful where you wander unannounced out here," I said, approaching her. There are at least a dozen couples fucking somewhere in this maze. She laughed a little as she turned to me. A bit of my concern eased when I saw the overflowing plate of food in her hand. If she'd been empty-handed, I'd know we were really in trouble.
Surprised you're not one of them, she said.
Yet. That thought distracted me briefly. I was joking, but also, it wasn't a bad idea. She scoffed, then took a bite of pastry.
That went well, she said through a mouthful. The ceremony, the party too. I haven't seen anyone die yet.
I wasn't sure if that was the measure of a successful royal vampire party or an unsuccessful one. But that thought faded away as I watched her. She was now carefully avoiding eye contact, looking very interested in the flowers. I thought you were done keeping secrets from me, Mish, I said. She stopped mid-chew, then turned to me, wide-eyed, dismayed.
She said she wouldn't tell you.
She? My eyes narrowed. She? Mish's eyes widened more.
Fuck, she hissed.
Right, fuck. Who is she, Araya?
I've got to go look at the...
She started to turn away, but I grabbed her elbow. Misha, what the hell is wrong? She let out a long sigh, then turned back to me.
I didn't want to do this here.
Do what? I hated when suspicions were confirmed. Misha hadn't been herself the last few weeks. She hadn't been the same since the prince. Or, who was I kidding? She hadn't been the same since the Moon Palace. My gaze fell to her arms and the long gloves covering the burn scars she didn't let anyone see, even me. What, Misha? I asked more gently. She nudged food around her plate with her fork.
I decided I'm going to go away for a while.
My heart sank. Away? Where? She shrugged.
I don't know. Everywhere? Anywhere?
We already did that, you and I. We saw everything worth seeing.
We never made it to the Lotus Islands.
I have. They're not that great. She still wouldn't look at me. Misha, if this is because of the House of Shadow, I started.
It's not, she said too quickly. It's...
She winced, squeezing her eyes shut. Then set her plate down on a stone wall. Whatever the House of Shadow does, we will deal with it, I said, voice low, and fuck, I meant that. We'll protect you. I'd never, never let them.
I know, she said. Trust me, I know. It's not about that.
I don't believe you.
Well,
she shrugged, opening her hands.
You have to. I was never meant for staying still, Rain, you know that. Not even before.
Funny how hundreds of years later she still stumbled over it every time she referenced her turning. But she was right, I did know that. That's why Misha and I had made such good companions for so long. We were running from a lot together, content to spend eternity letting the wind take us where it would. I thought that too, I said. But my voice trailed off because I hadn't really thought about it this way before, that I actually felt like I had a home now, beside Araya. I didn't have to run from anything anymore. For all the times I'd reassured Araya about her safety, I'd never felt safe myself. Not until I realized now. This can be good, Misha, I said. You have a home here. She smiled weakly.
You have a home here. This isn't my home.
But, I wanted to say, I thought your home was always with me. But none of this was about me. For a long time, Misha had been my little sister. I'd treated her as something to be protected, but she wasn't a child. She was an adult, and a damned capable one. When, I said.
Not for a while still. I told Araya, maybe a few weeks.
Araya. Oh, I'd almost forgotten about that interesting little tidbit. Speaking of Araya, I said, why do I have to start talking to my wife to find out what's going on in your head? Misha shrugged and said casually, "Maybe I just like her better than you."
I touched my chest and made an exaggerated expression of pain. Such a casual, fatal shot.
She laughed, and I was so grateful for the sound I didn't even care about the insult. Hell, I was glad she felt comfortable talking to Aurea if she wasn't going to be comfortable talking to me. But her laughter faded.
"It was just easier," she admitted. "It's just, it's you and me, you know?"
I did know. I understood exactly. Sometimes she and I were so close we couldn't really see or understand each other.
"And," she added, "I just didn't want to see you make that face. That sad face."
"The sad face?" "Did I make it?" I asked.
"Yes. It was heartbreaking."
I wasn't sure how to feel about that. "Listen, Misha. I will always support you going where you want to go and doing what you want to do with your life. And yes, I'll miss the hell out of you." Ix's tits, I really would miss her. "But if this is what you really want, then who am I to question that? You said this place isn't your home, but it can be. A home is somewhere you come back to. And if you really feel like you need to leave, that's fine. But this place, us, we will always be here for you to come back to." Her eyes, big and round, gleamed in the moonlight. Her lip wobbled slightly. The sad face, goddess damn it. "None of that bullshit," I grumbled. "You said a few more weeks, we can do this then." But before the words were out of my mouth, she threw herself against me in a hug. I grumbled, but folded my arms around her anyway, squeezing her tight. "A few weeks," I reminded myself. Hell, if I wasn't grateful for them. Saying goodbye to Misha would be like saying goodbye to an entire version of myself. Wasn't sure I was ready to do it tonight.
"Thanks," she murmured.
"For everything." I knew exactly what she meant. I knew it because I felt it too. "It's nothing," I said, even though we both knew it wasn't true. That was enough uncomfortably blatant emotion for Misha and me. We'd said all there was to say, and Misha wandered off, significantly lighter, to go find more food, leaving me alone to wander the gardens. I took a few minutes of solitude, collecting myself. I hadn't had much quiet time lately. It was actually nice, even if it was occasionally punctuated by the vocal moans of one couple or another from the shrubs. Eventually, I decided to go find Aurea. I wondered if she was still trapped in conversations with nobles or if she'd finally managed to extract herself too. Just as this thought crossed my mind, I turned a corner to see her standing at one of the garden walls, looking out over the festivities below. I stopped short. I couldn't help it. I needed to just take a minute to look at her. Her wings were out now, the red shockingly vibrant even under the moonlight. Her gown glittered like the night sky itself. And her posture. She held herself like such a queen. Sometimes, I found it impossible to imagine how Aurea had ever thought of herself as helpless. She was the most powerful person I'd ever met. I approached her. She turned before I made it to her side, and the little smile she gave me eased the remaining, lingering tension in my chest. "You escaped," I said.
"So did you."
"In a way. I found Misha instead." Maybe it was the bond that told Aurea what that meant, or maybe it was my face, or maybe both, because she cringed slightly.
"Oh."
"Mm-hmm."
"Are you all right?"
I shrugged. "She's her own person. If that's what she needs to do, that's what she needs to do." Aurea stared hard at me in a way that told me she knew I wasn't feeling quite so nonchalant about the whole thing. I sighed. "A few weeks is a few weeks. We'll deal with it then." I took a drink of my wine and then frowned down at it, wishing it was something more satisfying. Aurea followed my gaze.
"I think this party is hosting itself at this point," she remarked, looking out over the crowd. Then she met my eye with a playful, knowing glint.
Do you want to go somewhere more fun?
No hesitation. Fuck yes.
Chapter 80. Araya. I'd admit it. I now thoroughly enjoyed the taste of piss beer. Rain and I sat on a rooftop in the human districts, trailing our fine clothing all over the dirty clay roof, and watched the sky over the blocky buildings, the party reduced to a sparkling smear of light in the distance. Rain took an enthusiastic swig of beer. "This," he said, "is much better." I agreed. It was even worth the mild commotion that we'd caused getting the beer, crowns and all. At least the public reaction out here was more dumbstruck awe than pant-pissing terror these days. We'd been able to escape quickly afterwards, slipping off onto a quiet, shadowy rooftop in a near-abandoned block. I took a gulp of my own. It burned a little going down, probably doing some kind of lasting damage. "I have to say," I said, "it's grown on me."
"It's the Coriatis bond. It gives you good taste."
I chuckled. I watched him take another sip, transfixed by the wave of utter contentment that fell over his face. Mother, I loved watching him. The last time he and I had come up here in our fineries, escaping a stuffy party to go drink on a slum rooftop, I'd had every intention of killing him. The moment I realized I couldn't was one of the most frightening of my life. And this moment now, as it hit me all at once, just how staggeringly much he meant to me, came in close second. His eyes slipped to me.
"What's that face for, princess?"
I stared down into my beer, watching the reflection of the stars in the foamy darkness. I didn't answer right away. "Do you ever feel afraid?" It went against decades of training for me to even ask that question and reveal the weakness that lay beneath it. Even now, even with Rain, my husband, my bonded, whose heart was literally linked to mine. What was wrong with me? I wouldn't have blamed Rain if he'd laughed at me, but he didn't. His face was steady and serious.
"Everyone feels afraid."
It feels, I struggled to find the right word. I had lost everyone I had ever loved. And even those loves had been laced with so much pain, so much complication. My love for Vincent, tangled up in his lies and controlling disapproval. My love for Ilana, hidden in shadows and sharp words. My love for my mother, stolen from me entirely. The love I felt now for Rain was terrifying in its ease. I was afraid that something would come to rip it away from me. I was afraid that I would destroy it myself by not knowing how to feel something so right. "It feels like a trap," I whispered.
"The happiness," he finished.
I didn't confirm it, even though he was right. It felt like a ridiculous thing to admit.
"You've been fighting your entire life, Araya,"
he murmured.
"It makes sense. I feel it too."
My gaze snapped up. "You do?" He scoffed.
"You think I'm not terrified every time I look at you?"
He touched my face, tracing the curve of my cheek down to the point of my chin, his smile softening.
"Fuck, of course I am. You have my heart."
"You have my heart." Those words struck me hard. So true, on so many different levels. Rain had my heart, no matter how long I had denied that. He'd had it in every sense of the word long before I asked a goddess to bind it to him. And the Coriatis bond, powerful as it was still no less frightening than the love I felt for him. Hell, maybe the love scared me even more. To give someone that much of yourself. To give someone the power to destroy you. I could understand it. Why Vincent never learned how to do it. I could understand how it would be easier to never feel that kind of vulnerability. And yet, I pressed Rain's palm to my face, leaning into his touch. And yet, there was such safety in that vulnerability, too.
The ultimate paradox. But that made sense for us, didn't it? Rain and I were paradoxes. Human and Rishon and Hiage. Slaves and royalty. I know we'll still have to fight, he said. But we'll never have to do it alone again. That counts for something. It counted for everything. I smiled against his hand. You're an all right ally. He laughed, full and bright and alive, and mother, I would never in my life hear anything else so beautiful. I pulled away and turned back to the horizon. The sky was starting to turn pink. Sunrise soon, I said. We should be getting inside. But Rain shook his head. Not yet. I gave him a skeptical stare and he shrugged. It's not going to kill me, I promise. Besides, he pointed up to the crooked metal awning above him and made a point of scooting back flush against the wall. Look, I'm in the shade. I wasn't convinced. That's a stupid idea. Please, Princess, just a few minutes. You go out there and feel the sunrise. Maybe I'll feel it too. Bond and all that. I'll stay in the shade, and then we can go a block away to the apartment, and I can make passionate love to you for the next 7 hours. My eyes narrowed. He smirked. It's appealing to you, he said. I can tell. Goddess damn him. Then his face lit up. Look. I turned to see the sun scorching the horizon. The sky became a blazing fire of reds and pinks and purples as the orb of brilliant light rose above the sands of the dunes. My heart caught in my throat. I rose and stepped from beneath the awning into the red-orange light of the infant sun. The warmth suffused my skin, bathing me in it. I'd never much enjoyed the sunlight. For most of my life, I'd avoided it. Just another reminder of how I was different, inferior to the beings that surrounded me. Now that seemed outrageous. I spread my arms out and closed my eyes, soaking it into my skin. It's something, I said. Isn't it? Yes, Rain said softly. It's really something. But when I glanced over my shoulder back at him, he wasn't looking at the sun at all. My chest tightened, overflowing. So, I said, do you feel it? I'm not sure. He held out a hand. Come here. I obeyed, crawling back under the awning. And as soon as I was in arm's reach, his hands were all over me, his lips on my shoulder, my arms, my throat, my chest. Yes, he murmured. I think I feel it now. I let my eyelids flutter closed, let myself be surrounded by him as he kissed the dawn off my skin. My husband, my ally, my lover, facing a new day beside me. And as that golden sun crested the horizon, as a new year broke, as his lips found mine, my answer rose to the surface of my skin like the moon rising in the night sky. And not a single part of me doubted it as I whispered into his kiss, I feel it too. This is the end of book two, but the story continues with Six Scorched Roses, a Crowns of Nyaxia novella. Keep listening after the credits for a free preview. This has been a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more fantastical romance, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, X, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to The Ashes and the Star-Cursed King, Book 2 of Crowns of Nyaxia, produced by Mitch Rains, written by Carissa Broadbent, performed by Aiden Snow and Amanda Lee Cobb, members of SAG-AFTRA. Text copyright 2023 by Carissa Broadbent. Production copyright 2023 by Podium Audio, all rights reserved. And now, a first look at Six Scorched Roses, a novella from the Crowns of Nyaxia series. Part 1. The First Rose. Chapter 1. The first time I met Death,
It was in my first breaths, or rather the first breaths I didn't take. I was born too small, too sickly, too quiet. My father used to say that he'd never heard such a silence as when I was born. Several terrible minutes in which no one said a word. And that when I finally started to wail, he'd never been so grateful to hear a scream. Death never left, though. That became clear quickly, even before anyone wanted to acknowledge it. The truth came the second time I met Death, 8 years later, when my sister was born. She, unlike me, screamed from the moment she came into the world. My mother, on the other hand, went forever silent. My father had been right. There was nothing worse than that kind of silence. And it was in that horrible soundlessness, as I stifled my coughs and my tears with the back of my hand, that the healer gave me a strange look. Later, after my mother's funeral, he would pull me aside. "How long has your breathing been that way?" he would ask. Death always followed me, you see. It quickly became clear that I wouldn't have long to live. In the beginning, they tried to hide this from me, but I'd always liked knowing things. I was bad at reading people, but I was good at understanding science. I knew death even before I could name it. But the third time I met death, it hadn't come for me. It was given to the town of Adkova like a silk blanket, settling slowly over our lives, placed there by one of the gods themselves. Here's the thing about the god of abundance. Abundance wears many faces. The god of plenty is also the god of decay. There can be no life without death, no feast without famine. Like all the other gods, Vitaris is a fickle and emotional being. The difference between excess and absence, a mere whim of his moods. Entire lives, entire towns, made or unmade by a thoughtless wave of his hand. For a long time, Vitaris smiled upon Adkova. We were a flourishing farm town, nestled in a fertile patch of land. We worshipped all the gods of the White Pantheon, but Vitaris was the god of the farmer, and so he was our favored deity. For a long time, he treated us well. That changed slowly in the beginning. One spoiled crop, then two. Weeks, and then months of nothing. Then, one day, it changed all at once. You can feel it in the air when a god is nearby. I felt it that day. I opened my eyes and stared at the ceiling and could have sworn I smelled the smoke of funeral pyres. I went outside. It was cold, my breath coming in little puffs of white. I was 15, but looked younger. My body shook. I was very thin, no matter how much I ate. Death stole every mouthful, you see, and it had been especially hungry lately. To this day, I'm not sure where I went to the door. I was confused at first by what I was looking at. I thought my father was working in the fields, his form hunched and crouched in the dirt. But instead of the sea of greenery around him, there was only withered brown, coated with the wet, deadly sheen of frost. I had never been good at seeing the things that people didn't say, but even then, as a child, I knew that my father was broken. He clutched fistfuls of dead crops in his hands, sagging over them like lost hope. "Fa?" I called out. He looked over his shoulder at me. I pulled my shawl tighter around myself and shivered, despite the beads of sweat on my forehead. I couldn't stop the shaking. He looked at me the same way that he looked at those dead crops, like I was the corpse of a dream, buried in everything he couldn't save.
"Go back inside," he said.
I almost didn't. For years, I would wish that I hadn't. But how was I supposed to know that my father was about to curse a god that would curse us back? That's when the plague came. My father was the first to go. The rest, slower. Years passed, and Adkova withered like the crops in the field that morning my father had damned us all. It's strange to watch the world wither around you. I had always put such stock in knowing things, even the things that can't be known. The power of a god, the actions of a cruel, unfair fate, have a defined edge to them, a pattern that I could pull apart. I learned everything about the illness,
I learned how it stole breath from lungs and blood from veins, how it reduced skin to layers and layers of fine dust until there was nothing left but rotting muscle. Yet there was always something more there, something I couldn't ever really understand. Not truly. So much lived in that gap, the gap between the things I knew and the things I didn't. So much died there. No matter how many medicines I brewed or remedies I tested, the gap had teeth, like the vampires across the sea, teeth sharp enough to eat us all alive. 5 years passed. 10, 15. More people grew sick. The disease came for all of us in the end. Chapter 2. I always kept my workspace clean, but I took care to make it extra organized that evening. Beneath the waning light of sunset, which splashed bloody pink over my desk, I carefully sorted my notes and instruments. Everything was in its perfect place when I was done. Even a stranger could have sat down at my table and resumed my work. I figured this was practical, just in case I didn't come back. I was expendable, but the work wasn't. I surveyed my handiwork with a critical eye, then went out to the greenhouse. It wasn't a very pretty place, full not with colorful flowers, but instead spiny leaves and vines stuffed into glass jars. Not much wanted to grow here these days. Only one little piece of beauty glinted in the back, beyond the door that led to the fields. Once, when I was very young, these fields were full of crops. Now, only one patch of dirt flourished, a cluster of rose bushes, black flowers perched upon emerald leaves, each petal outlined in a shock of red. I carefully clipped a single flower, tucked it into my bag with special care, then went to the yard. Mina was sitting in the sun. It was warm, but she kept a blanket over her lap anyway. She turned to me and squinted into the waning light, looking at my bag. "Where are you going?" "Errands," I said. She frowned. She saw through the lie. I paused beside her for a moment, observing the darkness under her delicate fingernails, the heaviness of her breathing, observing most of all the fine coating of flesh-colored dust that settled over the chair and her blanket, her very skin abandoning her as death crept closer. I put my hand on my sister's shoulder, and for a moment I considered telling her that I loved her. I didn't say it, of course. If I did that, she would know where I was going and try to stop me. Besides, a word was useless compared to what I was about to do. I could show my love in medicine and math and science. I couldn't show it to her in an embrace. And what good would a thing like that do anyway? Besides, if I hugged her, maybe I wouldn't be able to let her go. "Lilith," she started. "I'll be back soon," I said. By the time I reached the doors, I was panting and sweating. I paused at the doorstep, taking a moment to collect myself. I didn't want whatever was about to greet me to see me looking like a mangy dog. I glanced over my shoulder, down the dozens of marble steps I had just scaled, and into the forest beyond. My town was not visible from here. It had been a long, long walk. Next time, I'd take a horse. I craned my neck up to the house before me. It was a strange collection of architectural elements. Flying buttresses and arched windows and marble columns, all mashed together in a mansion that really should have looked ridiculous, but instead stood in stubborn and intimidating indifference. I drew in a deep breath and let it out. Then I knocked and waited. And waited. Nothing. After a few minutes, I knocked again, louder. Waited. Nothing. I knocked a third time. A fourth, and then, finally, I thought to myself, well, this is the stupidest thing I'll ever do, and tried opening the door. The door, to my luck, or misfortune, was unlocked. The hinges squealed like this door had not been opened for a very, very long time. I had to throw myself against the mahogany to get it to budge. It was silent within, dusty. The interior of the house was just as strangely inconsistent in style as the exterior, though it took a few minutes for my eyes to adjust enough to see that. It was dark inside, the only light the moonlight spilling from behind me. The silver outlined the silhouettes of countless objects, sculptures and paintings and artifacts, and so much more I couldn't even begin to take in. Gods, it was mesmerizing. "Hello?" I called out. But there was no sound. No movement, save for the faint rustling of moth-bitten gauze curtains. Maybe he was dead. No one had seen him for a few decades. I'd be disappointed if I came all this way just to discover a rotting corpse. Did his kind rot? Or did they just...
"It appears," a deep voice said, "a little mouse has made its way into my home."
Chapter 3. There's nothing to be afraid of, I told myself, but that did nothing to stop the hairs from rising on the back of my neck. I turned, and though I was expecting it, the sight of him standing on the stairwell enveloped in shadow still made me jump, the way one jumps when a snake moves in the underbrush beneath your feet. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the deeper darkness of the stairwell. He stood at the top of the stairs, peering down at me with the vague curiosity of a hawk. He had long, dark brown hair, slightly wavy, and a neat beard. He wore a plain white shirt and black trousers, unremarkable, if a little outdated. He was large, but not monstrously so. I saw no horns nor wings, no matter how hard I squinted into the dark. I was almost a little disappointed by how normal he looked. Yet the way he moved betrayed his inhumanity. Or rather, the way he didn't. He was still the way stone was still. No minuscule shift to his muscles or rise or fall of his shoulders. No blink or waver of his gaze as it drank me in. You don't realize how much you notice those things in a person until they aren't there. And suddenly, every instinct inside of you is screaming, "This is wrong." He approached down the stairs, the moonlight illuminating bright amber eyes and a slow smile, a smile that revealed two sharp fangs. My chills were short-lived, drowning beneath a wave of curiosity. Fangs? Actual fangs, just like the stories said. I wondered how that worked. Did his saliva contain an anticoagulant or...
"Would you like to tell me what you're doing in my house?"
He had an accent, a sharp lilt stabbing into the T's and D's, rising the long A's and O's with a melodic twang. Interesting. I'd never heard an Obatrayan accent before. Then again, most people in the human lands never met anyone from Obitrace, because vampires didn't often leave their homeland and were usually better off avoided if they did. "I was looking for you," I said.
"So you come into my home uninvited?"
"It would have been easier if you had come to the door." He paused at the bottom of the stairs. Again, that vampire stillness, the only movement a single slow blink.
"Do you understand where you are?"
he asked. That was a stupid question. Maybe he was used to being cowered at. I did not cower. Why should I? I'd already met death 3 times now. So far, the 4th was a bit of a disappointment. "I brought a gift for you," I said. His brows lowered slightly.
"A gift,"
he repeated. "A gift." He cocked his head, a slow curl brushing his lips.
"Is the gift you?"
Another chill up my spine, and this time I shifted a little to ease it, which I hoped he didn't see. "No," I said.
"Not this time,"
he corrected, which I had no idea how to respond to. "The gift is very special. Unique. You're obviously a man who appreciates unique things." I gestured to the walls and the many artifacts that lined them. "In exchange, I ask you for a favor."
"That isn't a gift, he pointed out. That's payment, and I offer no services for sale.
Semantics, I said. Hear my offer. That's all I'm asking. He frowned at me, silent. I wondered if someone better at reading faces would be able to tell what he was thinking. But as it was, I certainly couldn't. After too long, I cleared my throat uncomfortably. Is there somewhere we can sit? I asked.
Sit?
Yes, sit. You must have lots of chairs in here. You must do nothing but sit, being in this mansion all by yourself all day and night.
Do I look like I do nothing but sit?
He took another step closer, and I looked him up and down without really intending to. No. He looked like he did a lot of moving. Probably sometimes lifting heavy things. I sighed, aggravated. Fine. We can talk here in the doorway if you want. He seemed like he was considering it, then acquiesced.
Come.
He brought me to a sitting room, which was even more cluttered than the entryway. This one, thankfully, was lit, albeit dimly, with lantern sconces that held peculiar blue flames. Paintings and shields and swords and scrolls plastered the walls. Overflowing bookcases were shoved into every corner, even in front of the windows, and the center of the room was full of mismatched fine furniture. Statues loomed over us, a jade cat staring us down from one side of the room, and a fierce, very naked woman, rendered in black marble, eyeing us warily from the other. The curtains were cerulean silk, and matching sweeps of fabric hung across the opposite wall, pulled back to reveal another expanse of paintings. It was a mess, and it was the most breathtakingly beautiful place I had ever seen. In 2 seconds, I identified art from 4 different countries in separate far reaches of the world. The sheer amount of knowledge in this room, I couldn't even imagine. My eyes must have gone a little wide, because he made a low noise that almost resembled a chuckle.
You dislike my decorating.
Dislike? I considered telling him this is the most incredible place I've ever been, but thought maybe now was not yet the time to start stroking his ego. What house are you? I asked instead. Another blink.
Excuse me,
he asked, like he thought he misheard me. Which house? From Obitrace? I gestured to the wall. This all seems too brightly colored to hail from the House of Shadow, and you seem far too sane to be from the House of Blood. So does that mean you're from the House of Night? His brows lowered again, now pressed so low over his amber eyes that they looked like 2 little jewels peering from pits of shadow. I didn't even need to question whether that was confusion. Good. Maybe he was surprised that any human cared to know about the 3 vampire kingdoms of Obitrace. But I liked making it my business to know things. It was the only thing I was any good at. And besides, when you don't have much time in this world, you want to fill it with as much knowledge as possible. He said,
Are you really not concerned that I'm going to eat you?
A little, a voice whispered in the back of my head. No, I said. If you were going to do that, you would have done it by now.
Maybe there were other things I wanted to do first,
he said in a tone that implied this often got much more of a reaction. I sighed wearily. Can we talk? I said. We don't have much time. He seemed a little disappointed, but then gestured to the sitting room. I took a seat in a dusty red velvet chair, perching lightly upon it with my back rod straight, while he settled into the opposite leather couch in a lazy lounge. Are you familiar with Adkova? I asked.
Familiar enough.
An illness is plaguing the city. His mouth quirked.
I had heard that one of your fickle gods had taken a bit of offense to that place. Shame.
As if Nyaxia, the vampire's exiled goddess, was any kinder of a god than ours. Yes, the 12 gods of the White Pantheon could be cold and fickle, but Nyaxia, the heretic goddess who had split from the Pantheon 2,000 years ago to create her civilization of vampires, was just as ruthlessly cruel. The illness is getting worse, I said. It is starting to expand to nearby districts. The death toll is in the thousands and will only rise. I blinked and saw dust, rancid dust swept from sick house floors and streets and bedrooms, swept 5-6 times a day from the church floors, funeral after funeral. I saw dust that I swept off of Mina's bedroom floor, a little thicker each day. The dust we both pretended did not exist. I cleared my throat. All of Edkova's and Basia's top scientists and doctors are working on finding a cure. And priests, and magicians, and sorcerers, of course. But I'd given up on thinking that they might save us. It was their god that damned us, after all. I think that you, Lord... I stuttered, realizing for the first time that I had never actually asked for his name.
Vale,
he said smoothly. Lord Vale, I clasped my hands before me. I think that you might have the key to a solution. He smirked at me.
Are you one of the country's top scientists and doctors?
My jaw tightened. I had always been bad at reading people, but even I could recognize that he was mocking me. Yes, I am. Again, that wrinkle between his brows. What? I snapped. Do you want me to be more demure about it? Are you about your accomplishments? Vale didn't look like he was especially demure about anything.
What is your name?
He said.
In case I need to verify your credentials.
Lilith.
Lilith.
Just Lilith. You gave me one name, so that's what I'll give you, too. He shrugged a little, as if he couldn't argue with that.
So, Lilith, how do you intend to save the world?
There it was again. That cloying coating of saccharine mockery, so thick that not even I could miss it. I said, I need your blood. A long silence. And then he laughed. The sound was low and restrained, and yet so thick with unmistakable danger. I wondered how many people had been given that laugh as their final goodbye to this world.
You came here to ask for my blood, he said.
All right, fine, I could see the irony. Yes, I said. I won't need too much, just a little. He stared at me incredulously. It won't hurt, I said, I promise.
I wouldn't think it would.
He straightened, crossing one leg over the other. I would only need 4 vials of blood each time. Maybe a little more if I need extra for additional tests. I would need to come once per month. He said without hesitation,
No.
I cursed silently to myself. Why not?
Because about 2 centuries ago, I decided that I would never again do anything I didn't want to do. And I don't want to. So no, Mouse. That is your answer.
I honestly didn't know how to respond to this. He'd seemed to be having such a fantastic time toying with me that it hadn't occurred to me that he'd flat out refuse. At least, not so unceremoniously. His face was a mask now. No wrinkled brow, no smirks. He spoke like he'd just turned down an invitation to dinner from someone he disliked. Pure indifference. My fingers curled and I pressed my hands against my skirts to hide the whitening of my knuckles. Of course, none of it mattered to him. What else could I expect from a creature like him, a creature that did not understand life, death, or suffering, but indifference? I forced myself to do what Mina would do. She would smile sweetly and charm. I was never good at being charming and didn't see much point in it most of the time, but it was worth a try. So I smiled, though it felt more like a baring of teeth. You didn't let me complete my offer, Lord Vale. In exchange for your blood, I'll give you a gift each visit. I reached into my bag and withdrew the rose that I had so carefully packed. I had to stare at it for a moment before I handed it to Vale. Did I imagine that it seemed even more beautiful in here? As if it was meant to exist in this room? He stared at it, face stone.
A flower. Very pretty.
He did not even try to hide how unimpressed he was. "I promise you," I said, "its beauty is by far the least interesting thing about it."
"Oh? And why is that?"
"You won't know unless you accept my deal." His eyes narrowed at me.
"How many?"
he asked. "Visits?"
"Roses."
"I'll visit you 6 times, and I'll bring you a rose each time." This time, I was expecting another unceremonious refusal. But instead, Vale examined the rose, twirling it slightly between his fingertips. He had a very cold, hard stare. It looked a bit familiar, and I couldn't place why until I realized that it was the stare of a scientist, someone used to analyzing things and taking them apart. A little spark of relief came with this realization, because that, at least, was something I understood. Maybe Vale and I were worlds apart in every way. Human and vampire, lord and peasant, near immortal and pitifully ephemeral. But if we had that, it was already more than I had in common with most of the people I'd grown up with.
"Fine," he said at last. "I accept your deal. Did you bring your equipment? Let's get this over with."
Of course I had brought my equipment. I had my needles and vials ready. Vale pulled up his shirt sleeve and extended his arm to me, and I drew his blood. Up close, he smelled like jasmine, both old and young at once, foreign and familiar. His skin was smooth and tan. When I touched his wrist to adjust the position of his arm, I jumped at the lack of warmth. But it also wasn't as cold as I'd imagined it would be. People spoke of vampires like they were walking corpses, but I'd seen many, many corpses, and Vale didn't look like any of them. Still, I wasn't quite sure what I was expecting when I pierced the smooth skin of his inner arm with my needle. I had to push much harder than I did with a human, and when the needle went through, it did so with a faint pop and abrupt force. The blood that flowed into my vial appeared to be the same consistency as human blood, but much, much darker, nearly black. I watched it, fascinated. Then, by the second vial, my eyes had drifted up to the rest of the room, taking in the tapestries on the walls, the books on the shelves. Gods, some of those tomes looked to be many centuries old, carelessly shoved into dusty corners. How old was Vale, I wondered. Legend said he had been here beyond the outskirts of Adkova for nearly 200 years. How many decades, centuries, of life had he lived before then? How much had he experienced?
"Are you enjoying looking?"
Vale's voice startled me. My eyes flicked back to him. He was now looking at me as he had looked at that rose, pulling me apart, petal by petal. "Are you?" I wanted to say. Instead, I said, "What will become of all of this when you die?"
"I'm immortal."
I scoffed. "You're not immortal. You're just very long-lived. That's an important distinction."
"By the time it matters, I'm sure I won't care."
It already looked a bit like Vale didn't care, judging by the condition of his living space. But I didn't say that either. A knot of jealousy formed in my stomach. He spoke with such blasé carelessness about all of this, about his life. The gluttony of it revolted me. He'd hoard all of this knowledge here, and he'd think nothing of it. Selfish. "I imagine it must become the only valuable thing after all that time," I said. The last vial was almost full. I watched the blood bubble up in the glass, ready to pinch off the needle. "Knowledge."
"Knowledge is cheap and dull,"
Vale said too casually, and I almost gasped at him in horror. "I can't imagine that ever being true. There's so much to learn about the world." He laughed a little, condescendingly, the way one laughs at a stumbling kitten. I corked the last vial and withdrew the needle from his arm. I found, with some surprise, that his skin had already healed around the needle tip. I had to rip it from his vein, which he didn't react to.
"After so long, you realize that knowing things doesn't especially matter very much. Knowledge with no context is meaningless. That's not the real treasure.
Oh? I tucked away my tools and stood. What is then? Vale stood too. He was quite tall, and he looked down at me with a wolfish kind of delight. He smiled, revealing those deadly fangs. The moonlight from the window glinted in his amber eyes. I felt, all at once, like an idiot for thinking before that he didn't look monstrous, because in this moment, with that smirk on his lips, I glimpsed the man of the legends, the monster of the whispers.
Curiosity, he said.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.